We would like to acknowledge that the land which we are gathered on today is the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe Nation, specifically the Chippewa Tri-Council, comprised of the Chippewas of Beausoleil, Rama, and Georgina Island First Nations, and more recently, the Mississaugas of the Credit River First Nation. Ontario is covered by 46 treaties and other agreements and is home to many Indigenous nations from across Turtle Island, including the Inuit and the Métis. These treaties and other agreements, including the One Dish with One Spoon Wampum Belt Covenant, are agreements to peaceably share and care for the land and its resources. Other Indigenous nations, Europeans, and newcomers were invited into this covenant in the spirit of respect, peace, and friendship. Most of us have come here as settlers, immigrants, or newcomers in this generation or generations past. We are all treaty people. Every day, we are mindful of broken covenants, and we strive to make this right. We commit to collaborating based on the foundational assumption that Indigenous peoples have their power, strength, and competency to develop culturally specific strategies for their communities. We are dedicated to honoring Indigenous self-determination, history, and culture, and are committed to moving forward in the spirit of reconciliation and respect with all First Nation, Métis, and Inuit people. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Beyond the Stethoscope, a podcast focused on hospice palliative care. Today, I'm very excited to have two wonderful speakers. Our first speaker is Inga De Bruin. She's a palliative care nurse consultant at the North Simcoe Muskoka Hospice Palliative Care Network, and Inga has worked at the network for over 10 years and is one of my colleagues. So welcome this morning, Inga.
Thank you very much, Linda.
And our guest is Corinne McNabb, a nephrology social worker, and she works with patients who have kidney disease in the regional kidney care program of Simcoe Muskoka. And Corinne has held this position since 1999. And welcome, Corinne.
Thank you, Linda.
We'll start off by asking some questions. And just for the speakers, I will add your name after the question so they know who's answering the question. And are you ladies ready to go?
Thanks, Joel.
That's fantastic. Inga, what is a palliative approach to care?
I'll give you the WHO definition, the World Health Organization definition of palliative care. It reads, palliative care is an approach that improves the quality of life of patients and their families facing the problems associated with life-threatening illness through the prevention and relief of suffering by means of early identification, impeccable assessment and treatment of pain and other problems like physical, psychosocial, and spiritual. So some of the principles that are associated with a palliative approach to care are, it's a holistic approach, providing social, psychological, spiritual, emotional support. It's a multidisciplinary approach, pulling from all of the resources available to improve quality of life for patients and their families. And quality hospice palliative care neither hastens death or wants to prolong life or suffering. It affirms life and regards dying as a natural process. It's available for people living with any illness and at any age and at any stage of an illness and who are willing to accept the care. It can be provided by specialist and non-specialist clinicians, and it's an approach, it's not a service. It is to provide excellent symptom management for pain, nausea, anxiety, depression, difficulty breathing, or anything else that might occur. And it can be provided anywhere, like at home, retirement home, long-term care facilities, hospital, hospice, jails, group homes, wherever there's people, it can be provided. Today, we are connecting a palliative approach to care with kidney disease, as it is a life-limiting, life-threatening disease.
Thank you, Inga. And as we know, we have multidisciplinary teams that work in a palliative care approach. So I love it that Corinne has joined us today. And Corinne, what is chronic kidney disease?
The Kidney Foundation of Canada defines chronic kidney disease as the presence of kidney damage or a decreased level of kidney function for a period of 3 months or more. Kidney disease can range from mild to severe, and in some cases lead to kidney failure, sometimes referred to as end-stage kidney disease or end-stage renal disease. Kidney disease often starts slowly and develops without symptoms over a number of years. So chronic kidney disease may not be detected until it has progressed to the point where your kidney function is quite low. Fortunately, most people do not progress to end-stage kidney disease, especially if they are diagnosed early and are able to take steps to preserve their remaining kidney function.
And Corinne, what are the risk factors for chronic kidney disease?
1 in 10 Canadians has kidney disease. It's important to know the risk factors and when to talk to your doctor about checking your kidney function. The main risk factors are diabetes and high blood pressure, also smoking, cardiovascular disease, a family history of kidney disease, children whose kidneys do not develop properly, chronic urinary or prostate problems, like kidney stones, etc., and people of Aboriginal, Asian, South Asian, Pacific Island, African, Caribbean, and Hispanic descent are at higher risk for kidney disease, but you may develop kidney disease even if you don't fall into one of these groups. Taking anti-inflammatory medications, being over 60, since as we age, we lose function naturally, and being an unhealthy weight.
And Corinne, Inga has explained what a palliative approach to care is, but why is it important to consider a palliative approach to care for patients with a diagnosis of kidney disease?
Living with a chronic illness of any kind often comes with many challenges, which I will talk about further later on. A palliative approach to care aims to provide supportive care and good symptom management to patients so they can better manage their illness. Patients also deserve to know the truth about what's happening to them so they can be prepared for what's coming down the road. They may have things they want to do or preparations they have to make. For example, if they will be off work for a period of time or even may have to stop working. They may want to get their affairs in order if they are anticipating their health will change and they have responsibilities they need to manage, either at work, at home, or within their family. For example, caregiving for children, a sick family member, or aging parents. They may want to travel while they are still well and have the energy and freedom to do so without the complication of also arranging and paying for treatments if they end up on dialysis. They may find that travel insurance is difficult to obtain once they have a pre-existing medical condition and or becomes very expensive to purchase.
Bryn, what are some of the symptoms of kidney disease or kidney failure?
Often there are no symptoms in the early stages of kidney disease, which is why it is even more important to be aware of the risk factors and speak to your family doctor about preventative measures you can take to preserve your kidney function. As kidney disease progresses to kidney failure, there may be more symptoms that you feel in these later stages. Not everyone experiences these, and not everyone experiences all of these symptoms, but the most common would be changes in appetite or taste, nausea, vomiting, tiredness, problems sleeping, restless legs, shortness of breath, changes in concentration and memory, and mood changes. As their disease progresses, patients may not be able to continue working or may have to modify their work to accommodate their treatment schedule or changing energy levels. This change in lifestyle may affect a patient's mood. For example, if their ability to work is changed, they may have to apply for and go on a disability income, which is a much lower income than what they were making by working. This can lead to stress and worry and sometimes even anxiety and depression. Their relationships may be affected. Sometimes this is the stress of living with a chronic illness or with changing roles in the family. For example, patients may not be capable of doing everything they once did to help out around the house, which creates additional work for someone else. Patients may experience sexual dysfunction caused by a medication they are taking and compounded by tiredness or fatigue. They may experience body image issues with the creation of their dialysis access, which could be a line, catheter, fistula, which we'll talk about a bit later, which in turn may affect their self-esteem. In the end, all of these things may have an effect on their intimate relationships. There may also be fertility challenges for men and women with end-stage kidney disease, and this may be a stressor in relationships when the plan was to have children. It will be important for patients and loved ones to keep the lines of communication open, keep talking about what's going on and how they're feeling about it, and also to reach out to their family doctor and kidney team to learn about supports available to them. There may be some helpful resources out there that they were not aware of.
Bryn, how can we support people with kidney disease with a palliative approach to care? It sounds very complex since you've described the symptoms that they have and the effects on the person.
Well, like any good palliative care, support through this journey to the patient and their family, good symptom management, education about treatment options, what to expect as their disease progresses, and connection to services and help at home as needed.
And again, Corinne, what are some supports that are available to patients with kidney disease and their families?
All patients have access to a multidisciplinary team for medical care, support, information, education, resources, and symptom management regarding their health, diet, medications, and coping with a chronic illness. Their team consists of nephrologists, which are the kidney doctors, nurses, social workers, dietitians, and pharmacists, and in some programs could include psychologists, physiotherapists, spiritual care, etc. Patients have access to this team wherever they are along their kidney disease journey. The Kidney Foundation of Canada is our most important partner. They provide education materials, manuals, brochures, the Kidney Community Kitchen, which has menus, recipes, and video demonstrations, peer support, support groups for peer and caregiver, patient forums, webinars, and other resources for patients. They are a reliable source of information for anyone who would like to jump online and learn more about kidney disease. There are also some financial supports available to patients, disability pensions, last resort funding from the Kidney Foundation, tax credits. There's also a registered disability savings plan, an RDSP, community programs such as hydro rebates if they qualify, to name just a few. I hesitate to get into specifics since programs vary across counties, regions, and provinces. Social workers can guide patients and families through what is available to them and assist them in determining eligibility for these programs.
And Dinga, how can the North Simcoe Muskoka Hospice Palliative Care Network support people living with kidney disease and their family members?
Sure. A palliative approach to care is all about having the best quality of life wherever a person is in their life or illness trajectory. From time of diagnosis up until time of death, it's so important to open communications and have conversations all along. At the network, we can help with those conversations and have all members of the team more comfortable in having those conversations. If conversations about expectations, wishes, concerns, and hopes are started early on, we can help provide a better experience for patients, families, and even healthcare providers. We can also support healthcare providers with symptom management along the whole trajectory of the disease process. As I said earlier on, a palliative approach to care is a team approach. As healthcare providers, we are all part of that team. We all provide palliative care, if we realize this or not. At the North Simcoe Muskoka Hospice Palliative Care Network, we can provide formal and informal educations to healthcare providers and support a team in any way we can. All our education offerings can be found on our website at www.nsmhpcn.ca, and a lot of them are for free or for a very minimal cost.
Inga, who should initiate discussions about advanced care planning?
As palliative care is provided by everybody in the team, any one person in a team can talk about advanced care planning. It could be the MRP, the most responsible practitioner, or the nurse at the clinic. But it could also be a family member, social worker, or anybody else in the team. Advanced care planning is thinking and talking about future care. Who is your SDM, your substitute decision maker? Where do you see yourself at end of life? What are your hopes and wishes? It's a conversation that not happens just once. It's an ongoing conversation about hopes and wishes. It also is a way to decide who your SDM, your substitute decision maker, will be in case you lose the capacity for making decisions for yourself. When having those conversations early on with your family members and your POA appointed SDM, it can make those times, if you lose capacity, a lot easier for your family and your SDM. Therefore, most likely with the outcome that you would have wanted to have for yourself. Advanced care planning is thinking about and planning for the future.
So I'd like to ask both of you, Inga and Corinne, to discuss goals of care and why is that important?
All patients in a regional kidney care program in Ontario are expected to have a documented goals of care discussion with their healthcare team at least once a year. This includes a discussion about advanced care planning, so as Inga has described above, identifying a substitute decision maker and asking and or educating about power of attorney documents and wills, funeral pre-planning, talking about future care, but also establishing illness understanding, addressing resuscitation status, and determining the patient's goals. By having these conversations, we hope to give patients more of an opportunity to talk to us about their hopes and wishes, fears and concerns, to ask questions they maybe haven't had a chance to ask or wanted to ask, and to give them time with someone who is willing to sit down with them and have a real conversation. Sometimes they choose to discuss things with us that they are not ready to discuss with their families, like what happens if they decide to stop dialysis. Often patients are seen for many years in clinics or on dialysis, and they develop quite a rapport with their healthcare team. We may even see patients, especially those that come to the hospital for hemodialysis 3 times a week, more than they see their families. It makes for some interesting conversations.
The goals of care conversations are today's or this week's hopes and wishes, and they could change at any time as soon as health status changes. Goals of care conversations could and should happen again and again, and at any time when health status changes or life changes happen.
Yes, that's so very important to have those conversations. And Corinne, as their kidney disease progresses, what can patients expect?
As their kidney disease progresses, patients may start to feel some of the symptoms that I talked about earlier. If they are feeling quite fatigued, those patients who had still been working may need to stop working for a period of time or stop working entirely and go on to a disability pension. If they progress to kidney failure, they will need to make a decision about what kind of treatment they would choose for their kidney disease, whether that's dialysis, transplant, or conservative care.
Bryn, can you talk a bit more about the treatment options available to people with kidney disease?
Patients may be referred by a nephrologist, that's that kidney doctor, to a multi-care kidney clinic when their kidney function is under 30%. This is a clinic where they have access to that multidisciplinary team for support, information, and symptom management. That team consists of the kidney doctor, the nurse, social worker, dietitian, and pharmacist. They would have their blood work taken before they come to clinic, and they are also asked to fill out an ESAS, or an Edmonton Symptom Assessment System sheet. This is a gold standard symptom assessment tool developed originally in the cancer community, which tracks symptoms from nausea, shortness of breath, and tiredness, to depression, anxiety, and well-being. 3 symptoms have been added for kidney patients specifically: restless legs, problem sleeping, and itchiness. At the clinic, the team uses all of this information, blood work, a physical assessment, and the ESAS, to guide the conversation with the patient and their family about how they're doing, any changes in their condition, medication and diet changes, symptom management, and what to expect as their disease progresses. The goal of this multi-care kidney clinic is to stabilize patients and their kidney function, and we often had good outcomes when patients work with the team and make changes to their diet, medications, and lifestyle, controlling blood pressure and blood sugars, etc. but kidney disease is a progressive disease, so eventually patients may come to a point where they do need to make a decision about next steps. To this end, once a patient's kidney function declines to under 20%, they are asked to come to a modality choice appointment to discuss all of their treatment options. Generally, people do not start a treatment until their kidney function is below 10%, but we like to start planning early if we can, so there are fewer surprises, and we can often avoid emergency procedures and hospital admissions. At this appointment to talk about treatment options, they are given information about different types of dialysis, which includes in-center hemodialysis, which is the treatment they would receive at the hospital, usually 3 times a week for about 4 hours a session. This is a treatment that uses a machine with a filter attached that cleans a patient's blood directly. Patients have an access somewhere in their body, the most common being either a central line called a catheter or it's tubing in their neck, or what we call a fistula in their arm. A fistula is an access created by a vascular surgeon that attaches a vein and an artery under a patient's skin to make their veins bigger, so we can eventually put needles into their veins. The machine draws their blood out through tubing attached to their access and circulates it continuously over the 4 hours through the filter, removing toxins and excess fluid. About a cup of the patient's blood is outside their body at any given time. Patients often report feeling very washed out after this type of treatment, and they go home to sleep. Most patients feel better the next day, but everyone is different. Patients may feel too tired to drive home after this procedure, so they often have family members pick them up or use third-party transportation for a fee. If they do drive themselves, there may be a cost for parking at the hospital. Home hemodialysis is when patients learn to do this treatment themselves at home, usually with a caregiver. They may do the same amount of dialysis that they would do in-center or in the hospital 3 times a week. Some patients do home hemodialysis every other day, and some patients do what's called nocturnal hemodialysis, the Cadillac of dialysis, where they dialyze 6 nights a week. This gives the patient blood work that is close to normal as they can have without a transplant. Patients have about 6 weeks of training to learn how to do home hemodialysis, and then they are expected to come back to a clinic to see the multidisciplinary team every 2 months. We talked earlier about fertility challenges in end-stage kidney disease. Some female patients who would like to become pregnant have found that they can be more successful with doing daily or nocturnal dialysis and having close medical follow-up. Peritoneal dialysis is another type of dialysis that patients can learn to do themselves at home. Peritoneal dialysis is a type of treatment that uses the peritoneal membrane, which is the membrane that covers your internal organs, to diffuse toxins and fluids, so there is no direct access to blood. Rather, a catheter or tube is inserted into the patient's belly, and the patient uses this to fill and drain their belly with dialysate or cleaning fluid several times a day. Or they may connect to a machine overnight that does these exchanges, which is the drain and fill, for them. This kind of dialysis is gentler since it's done every day or every night and is most like the function of our native kidneys. Since it is also a more portable type of treatment, patients often choose this kind of dialysis when they want more independence from the hospital or live a distance away, like to travel or go to their cottage or fly south for several months at a time. They will also have to come to the hospital for their initial training, 3 to 5 days, but then after that, if all is going well, only every 2 months or so for a clinic visit to see their kidney team. Again, as discussed above, there may be body image issues with weight gain or carrying fluid in their bellies. With an ever-present catheter, some patients have reported issues with intimacy. Communication with loved ones is key. Then there's transplant, which is still considered a treatment, not a cure. Patients have to undergo rigorous testing to determine if they are a candidate for transplant, which is considered a major surgery. Then we refer them down to Toronto for final assessment. The hospitals in Toronto that do kidney transplants are St. Michael's and Toronto General. So there's lots of travel back and forth for testing, assessment, information sessions, and then of course the surgery. The patient still has to go back to Toronto after surgery for blood work in the first month or so. And then they may be able to do their blood work in their hometown after they are medically stable and their medications are regulated. The patient will have to take anti-rejection drugs for as long as they have the kidney. These are medications that lower their immune system, so their body does not reject the new kidney. They also may be at greater risk for illnesses like cancer. During COVID, for example, we also saw that transplant patients did not have the same response rate to the vaccines. They had to be extra vigilant about avoiding the virus. If a patient has someone willing to give them a kidney, they can also have what's called a living donor transplant. And they can sometimes even have this surgery before they need to go on dialysis, so can preempt dialysis. If they don't have a living donor, then they go on a waiting list once they start to dialysis to wait for a deceased donor kidney, or a kidney from someone who has died on life supports and donated their organs. While it is the best treatment option for many patients and returns their life to as close to normal as possible, transplantation is obviously not without its own risks and is not for everyone. And finally, conservative care. Conservative care is when someone decides not to do dialysis.
Bryn, what happens if someone actually decides not to do dialysis, and why might they actually make this decision? Could you explain that for us, please?
Sure. So everyone has the right to choose whether they accept treatment or not, and it's the same for dialysis. Some patients may decide that they have had a good life and they don't want to end their life with invasive procedures and treatments. Some patients have many comorbidities or other illnesses in addition to their kidney disease or that have caused their kidney disease. By the time they progress to kidney failure, dialysis may be one more thing that they do not want to endure. In fact, after a certain age, which is around 75, and with many other health conditions, dialysis may not even prolong a patient's life significantly and will add many other burdens. As I talked about before, travel and cost of medications, special diet, caregiver stress, invasive procedures, surgeries, possible hospital admissions, fatigue, risk of falls, etc. If someone chooses not to have dialysis, we will still follow them in our kidney care clinic as long as they want to or are able to attend. We follow their blood work, assess and offer symptom management as needed, make a referral for palliative and home supports in their community, and encourage good advanced care planning conversations, including conversations about where they would want to be for end of life.
Bryn, what happens if someone decides to stop dialysis?
Since dialysis is considered a life support treatment and kidneys are vital organs, if someone has been doing dialysis and decides to stop, and people do this for various reasons, as we talked about, they may not live long and are considered at end of life. We would want to ensure at that point that they have the supports they need for symptom management and comfort care wherever they decide they'd like to be to die, whether that's at home, hospital, or residential hospice. Stopping dialysis can be quite peaceful, but we don't really know how long it's going to take for someone to die. I've seen it happen on the same day as the patient decides to stop treatment, and I've witnessed it taking much longer, although the average time is generally 10 days to 2 weeks. It usually depends on how long someone has been on dialysis, how much kidney function they have left, and on their other underlying health conditions. Often the patient's biggest worry is how their family will cope during this time. It's interesting that when discussions began about MAID in Canada, it was felt that dialysis patients may not qualify or may not need MAID since they could just stop dialysis. Ethicists were consulted and eventually this was changed. Unfortunately, examples were presented to patients who had lived for some time after stopping dialysis, in some cases demonstrating unnecessary suffering for themselves and their families, which is exactly why we have MAID, so this doesn't happen. We've only had one patient in our program to date choose MAID instead of stopping dialysis, although I hear from colleagues in other programs that they have had many patients choose this option. For some patients, it is a relief just to know that they have an option to stop dialysis when they feel they can no longer tolerate it or no longer have the quality of life they want for themselves. We do our best to support patients with whatever treatment decisions they make.
Ingo, what kind of services can be provided at end of life?
In Ontario, we have home and community care service support services that support people in their home, retirement homes, with nurses, PSWs, occupational therapist, physiotherapist, speech and language pathologist, social worker, dietary supports, and perhaps even more. This might all look a little bit different depending on the area that you live in and the available services in that area. As well, they might have some material supports as electric beds, commodes, etc. But this is all according to their assessment for eligibility. There is, however, a big shortage in our healthcare providers, making it very difficult at the moment for patients or for people to stay at home for end of life if they don't have a big support system of their own, in like their families and friends. We have residential hospices for end of life care at our facilities, so facilities where people go for the end of life and the dying process. And we also have hospices with grief and bereavement supports and visiting volunteers and multiple other programs. Sometimes they are combined supports coming from the residential hospices, but I know in Kuching area, there are two separate organizations working closely together. Every area might have just slightly different supports depending on what's available. Another option for people is to spend their end of life in an acute care setting, so a hospital. A palliative approach to care also will support family and friends after their loved one has died. We have to remember that it's all about the experience from patients as well as the people that are going to be left behind. If we can support all, we can make this world just a little bit of a better place to be. And to me, that's improving quality of life for everybody involved.
Come to the end of our discussion and questions. I just want to thank both of you ladies for joining me today. That was an absolutely robust conversation with so much information. And I actually myself have learned a lot today. Certainly looking after patients and their families with chronic kidney disease is a specialty all in its own. And it's very complex. Thank you for the work that you ladies do every day. And thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you, Linda.
Thank you, Green.
Thanks, Inga.